That's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening to a pretty telling echo of a living American history. It's not something you hear every day. Legislators in South Carolina last night saying goodbye to a flag, the Confederate flag.
So my question to you is the flag that's flying on top of the dome right now offensive to anybody in this room?
Lonnie Hosey, if that flag hurts your heart, it hurts my heart.
The right thing to do is what we call the healing thing.
I cannot believe that we do not have the heart in this body to do something meaningful, such as take a symbol of hate off these grounds on Friday.
There's something so authentic and honest about these voices, as complicated and menacing as the flag is, these emotions and actions, decisions and epiphanies, all set in motion by the shooting in Charleston last month. We'll hear more of those voices later on this hour. It's not the only history that speaks in the difficult choices we face in America today. The Obama administration announced this week new regulations to try and do something more challenging than taking down a Confederate flag, to change historic and deliberate patterns of segregation in American neighborhoods. Here's how Housing and Urban Development Secretary Julian Castro says the federal government can lead the way to housing integration. Castro put it this way officially in a conference call with reporters.
The federal government should never plan for communities. It should plan with them. And we're eager to support local leaders in giving every person an equal chance to access quality housing near good schools, transportation, and jobs, no matter who they are, what they look like, how they worship, or where they're from.
The new rules will make federal aid conditional on monitoring of housing patterns for racial bias, publicly reporting those results, and making improvements. The Obama administration aims to undo decades of segregated housing policy. In light of the historical echoes in the Confederate flag debate, how hard is integration going to be to achieve? Richard Rothstein is a research associate at the Economic Policy Institute and a fellow at the UC Berkeley School of Law. Christine Klepper is a veteran advocate fighting housing discrimination in Chicago for more than 40 years. She's executive director of the Housing Choice Partners Organization in Chicago. Rothstein says if you want to see this country's racial history, just take a drive to any urban area in America.
Most people today think that the segregation we have in our major metropolitan areas came about by accident. But in fact, the segregation of our metropolitan areas was created by explicit, racially conscious federal policy that was designed to segregate our metropolitan areas. It's not the unintended consequence of other policies. The two major policies that the federal government followed were, first, the public housing program, which began in the 1930s, in which they demolished integrated urban neighborhoods. At that time, urban neighborhoods were integrated because workers had to live close enough to the factories where they worked to be able to walk to work. So they demolished integrated urban neighborhoods and built segregated public housing in their place, creating segregation in cities across the country, north, south, east, and west, where segregation had never previously existed. And then secondly, also beginning in the 1930s, the Federal Housing Administration guaranteed bank loans to mass production builders to create suburbs around every metropolitan area. And those federal guarantees were conditioned on a commitment by the developers not to sell any homes to African Americans. So places like Levittown outside New York, or your listeners are probably familiar with a song that Pete Seeger used to sing about houses on a hillside made of ticky-tacky south of San Francisco. Those were all segregated, white-only developments built with federal guarantees on condition that they be white-only. So the entire country was suburbanized as a white-only suburban noose around central cities. Whites who were living in public housing at the time were lured out of the public housing into these white-only suburbs. They could buy homes with FHA and VA guarantees and pay monthly charges that were less than the rent they were paying in public housing.
Christine Klepper, how does that manifest itself, if indeed it does, in Chicago? And what has been effective in reversing that formidable federally induced trend?
Well, as Richard said, minorities, especially African Americans in Chicago, as well as across the nation, have been so highly concentrated, isolated, and that's very damaging. Lots of research has come out recently about the damaging effects of living in toxic neighborhoods, highly distressed neighborhoods, especially for children. We know that cognitive learning is affected. We know even lifespans and health are affected. So we run a program where we work with voucher holders to help them move to opportunity neighborhoods. So opportunity neighborhoods have better schools, lower crime, and they're places where children can reach their full potential. For example, the families that we work with, they're highly motivated to do something better, to get out of poverty. I think the main motivating factor for families to move is safety. And then good schools. Kids are so often trapped in underperforming schools where they can't compete for jobs when they grow up. So we're hoping that this new rule is going to provide more opportunity, more choice, and the better life outcomes that we're looking for and that families are looking for.
Do you see, Richard, that the new federal rules can actually address some of what you were talking about a moment ago?
They can, but it's not going to be easy. It's going to take a lot of muscle, and it's going to be controversial. The programs that Christine was just talking about, for example, are not possible in most places in the country because many suburbs, again, with racially explicit motivation, adopted zoning rules that prohibit either multifamily housing from being built. The cities retain and the suburbs retain the right to veto projects that include moderate and low-income housing. The federal government is going to have to, in enforcing this rule, crack some eggs, and it's not going to be easy. In 1970, the Nixon administration actually tried to do this. They adopted a policy that middle-class white suburbs, in order to receive federal funding for water projects or sewers or anything that they use federal funds for, were going to have to repeal their exclusionary zoning ordinances, were going to have to accept housing that was public, and they were going to have to accept subsidized low and moderate income housing. That was so controversial that the program was canceled. And this new rule that the HUD is adopting is a revival of that policy, but it will be equally controversial, and there's going to have to be a lot of fortitude on the part of the federal government to enforce it.
Revisiting a Nixon administration policy scheme, that's pretty interesting here. Talk about echoes of history here. But, you know, it sounds to me like it's much easier to create an ordinance to keep people out. It's much more challenging of a policy question to create laws that will bring people in without planning communities, as Secretary Castro said, that we don't want to be actually planning communities like, you know, they do in Russia or China. Is there something that is actually doable here as far as welcoming people in that could have a tangible effect on segregation, Christine?
Well, actually, yes. I think we have shown that we can make these moves using the voucher program. It doesn't involve zoning or development or any of those things. It's a single individual using a subsidy, renting in the private market from a landlord. And most people don't know about if a voucher holder lives in their neighborhood or not. You know, again, we've found through studies looking at the few mobility programs that have existed that they work. We have to work more obviously on the things Richard talks about in terms of zoning and developments, but we have at least one strategy that we know works, and if we could bring it to scale, have more mobility programs around the country, I think we have at least one piece of the puzzle for beginning to impact intergenerational poverty.
Planning got us into this, and aggressive planning, in the words of Richard Rothstein, is going to get us out of it. Richard Rothstein is research associate at the Economic Policy Institute and a fellow at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. He's the author of the new report, The Making of Ferguson. And Christine Klepper is executive director of Housing Choice Partners in Chicago. Christine and Richard, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.